The topic that I will be covering in this talk is how to obfuscate network topologies such that they appear to be secure against a particular kind of denial of service attacks, which is called link flooding attacks. And this project is joint work together with Petar Tsankov, Laurent van Wever, and Martin Vetche from ETH Zurich, as well as Vincent Lenders from ArmaSwiss. And for the beginning, let's start with the example of such a small network. And let's assume that in this network, some of the hosts are infected, are participating in a botnet, and some others are not and are potential targets of attacks. Now, a link flooding attack, as opposed to a traditional denial of service attack, does not target a particular end host, but instead it targets the infrastructure connecting the network. So, for example, such a link flooding attack would work by having the botnet sending many small flows from many different sources to many different destinations, but all of these flows have one thing in common, and that is that they cross one particular link. And while the volume of each flow individually is small, the aggregated volume that is crossing this targeted link is enough to introduce congestion on this link. Now, such attacks actually happen. One example was against a provider of secure email services. This provider or its ISPs were attacked in many ways, and one of the attacks was of this link flooding type. So the problem with these attacks is that they are very hard to even detect, because as I already said, the flows between the hosts, from the sources, one of the hosts in the botnet, destination can be another host in a botnet or a public server. These flows are very small. They can appear like normal network traffic, and it's very hard to identify that such an attack even happens, because the increase of volume on the network edge is very small, and only on the targeted link the increase of volume is large. But as a major requirement to launch such an attack, the attacker needs to know the topology, because she needs to pick the flows or the sources and the destination of the flows such that they actually cross this attacked link. And even though most network operators don't publish their topologies and not their forwarding configurations, there are ways to find it out. One way to find a particular path in a network that you probably all know is done by using a tool called Traceroute. And this Traceroute tool, executed on one host with destination another host, will send a sequence of IP packets with increasing time to live values, such that later one can observe the path that packets take between the source host and the destination. So it starts with a packet with destination this host X on the right and a time to live of 1. This packet will only go to the first route, because the time to live specifies how many hops a packet can take before it expires. So this packet will expire at the first router. The router will notify the sending host about this, telling that this packet expired at router A. And from this reply, the host knows that the first hop in the path between the host and destination X is router A. Then next packet will have time to live 2. This goes up to the second router. From the reply, the host knows the second hop in the path towards X. And this is then repeated until a packet reaches X, and until the host or this traceroute tool has determined the entire path that packets take from the source host on the left to the destination host X on the right. And now, a naive approach to map an entire network topology would be to execute this traceroute technique from between all pairs of hosts. However, existing work has actually shown that the actual number of these measurements that are needed are much smaller than all pairs of nodes, and that one also does not need its own botnet to run such measurement. And in fact, there are like public measurement platforms that can run these measurements. So what I said so far is that we were looking at mitigating link flooding attacks, that for these link flooding attacks, an attacker needs to know the topology. And to know the topology, the attacker needs to somehow determine it, for example, by using these traceroute-like techniques. So if we have this, then the solution to mitigate such attacks would be just to hide the topology from an attacker, right? And the answer to this is yes, it would be a solution, but the problem is with this, you make a lot of non-malicious users unhappy, because as it turns out, this traceroute tool or similar techniques are one of the main tools that people use to debug network connectivity issues. So by just hiding the topology or by blocking these traceroute tools, one would remove an important debugging tools for legitimate network users. And I've shown here a few examples of emails from the NANOG mailing list, which is the North American Network Operators Group mailing list, that show that people actually in practice very often use this traceroute tool to debug connectivity or routing problems. So our approach then was, maybe we can just hide parts of the network topology. And if we only hide small parts, we would make the legitimate users still happy, because they can do most of their debugging stuff, but we would remove the information that is interesting for an attacker. And this then leads to two questions. First of all, which parts of the network do we want to hide? And second, how do we want to hide it? And these are two questions that I will answer in the remaining of this talk. And I will group the talk into three sections. In the first part, I explain how our NetHide system takes the existing physical topology as an input and produces a virtual topology that is robust against link flooding attacks and is still similar to the physical topology. In the second part, I will explain you how NetHide deploys this virtual topology on top of the existing physical topology using programmable networks. And in the last part, I will give you some brief insights in the evaluation that we did. We are not the first ones to look at link flooding attacks. And in general, mitigating these attacks can be, the solutions to mitigate these attacks can be classified into two categories. The first one would be reactive, that are approaches that act upon a link flooding attack is happening, and then they try to, for example, modify the bandwidth of flows or the routing with the goal of being able to distinguish between attack traffic and legitimate user traffic. The problems with these approaches is that they don't actually prevent the link flooding attacks, and they have an impact on the production network traffic. The second category are proactive approaches, which usually apply some kind of obfuscation in order to prevent link flooding attacks. But the problem there is that they have an impact on these debugging tools that non-malicious users are using. And so our approach falls into the second category, but with also a particular focus on maintaining the usability of these debugging tools. So let me now come to the first part of, to the first building block of our system, which takes the physical topology as an input and produces a virtual network topology that is robust against link flooding attacks and has maximum practicality. What do we mean by robust against link flooding attacks? For this, let me first briefly summarize the attacker model that we assume. We assume an attacker that has control over a certain number of bots, for example, of a botnet, and has a certain number of flows to run. While by flows here, we mean traffic between routers, so not individual TCP flows, for example. And we assume that the attacker has no prior knowledge of the topology and that she uses these traceroute-like techniques to map the topology in the beginning. A topology that is secure against such an attacker is one where, for each link, the load on this link, so which we measure in terms of the flow density or just the number of flows that use these links, is smaller or equal than the capacity of this link. Now, if we have this property holds for a physical topology, we don't need any obfuscation at all. If it doesn't hold, then we will modify this topology such that we obtain a resulting topology for which this property holds. Now that if you know that we applied this kind of obfuscation, you could, of course, still try to attack this. And for this, we identified two basic strategies. You can try to invert the obfuscation that I describe in the remaining of this talk. However, the problem here is that this is infeasible for many reasons. A few of them I will mention later in the talk, and the full discussion of this is in the paper. The other strategy would be to look at the virtual topology and to try to guess a feasible attack that works in the physical topology. Here, this can work, but as we show with simulations in the paper, the overhead that is introduced by this is quite significant. So the second property now that we want of our from our virtual network topology is that it has maximum practicality. And by practicality, we mean that it has two properties. The first one is a static measure by which we compare the path that flows take in the physical topology and those that they take in the virtual topology. And with the second property, we want that dynamic events such as link failures are represented in the virtual topology. So an example for the first part would be that if we have this this physical path that packets actually take, we would like to have a path between the same hosts in the virtual topology to be somehow similar, ideally identical, and we don't like a path that is completely different with completely different nodes or completely of a different length. And this property we call accuracy. The second property here, we want that if a link failure occurs in the physical topology, that this link failure is accurately represented in the virtual topology and that it does not appear as multiple or no link failures in the virtual topology. And this property we will call the utility. So now that we have the goal, the properties that we want from our virtual topology, the next question is how do we actually compute it? And what we did is we implemented this as an optimization problem, as an ILP, and we solved it for the best result that for a topology that is secure and it has the maximum accuracy and utility. One problem there is that the number of possible solutions is exponential because the exponential number of ways one could build a topology consisting of n nodes. So we did one optimization there, is that we randomly sample from the exponential space of possible solutions a smaller linear space of configurations. So these are not, we don't sample entire topologies, we sample the forwarding behavior towards each node, and then we pick the best combination of these linear number of forwarding behaviors. And this gives us much better performance. It also makes it harder to invert the obfuscation because we have this randomness that we introduced, and it, as we will show in the evaluation, it still gives us high accuracy and utility. So now I'm coming to the second part, in which I will describe how we deploy this virtual topology that we obtained in the first part on top of the existing physical network using programmable network technologies. For this, we want to do in such a way that debugging tools such as this traceroute that I've shown before still work, that the network performance is not affected, and that it scales to large network. Now, a very naive solution to deploy a virtual topology would be that we just take all these traceroute packets or the replies to these packets and we answer to them from a central controller by some proxies at the network edge, or we send them through a virtual simulated network instead of the real one. However, the problem with these approaches is that if you have, for example, a link failure in the real network, you would not observe the link failure in the virtual network or in the traceroute queries that you do in all of these approaches. So what we do instead is we send the traceroute packets through the actual network such that they expire at the correct router that we show in the virtual path, and that really the answer comes from the router that we show in the virtual path. Now, since this router is on a different location than it is, like the virtual path is different than the physical path, and we might need to modify the packet somehow that it actually expires on the correct node and that it even goes to this node. And for this, we use programmable networks. In particular, we use a programming language called P4, which allows us to program the data plane of a network with very good performance. So this P4 language supports only quite basic operations and instructions, but the operations that are supported, they later can run in hardware with very high speed. And these operations include that we can modify some header fields or all header fields of a packet. We can recompute checksums, for example, which is needed after we modified packet headers. And we can also add or remove custom headers to packets. And the basic idea is that later we will have we will tell each of the programmable devices that if it receives a packet to a destination X with a time to live I, it should modify this packet such that it is sent to destination Y with time to live J. And the idea is that each of the programmable devices then has a list of these entries and can modify traffic accordingly. Now, this solves kind of one part of the problem, that the packet expire at the correct router. The other part is that the reply that these routers send also contains the original packet that they received, or at least part of the original packet. And so we cannot directly send this back to the sender, otherwise the sender would see what we modified. And to do this in a way that scales to large network, we encode the original contents of the packet in an additional header before we send it to the router. So the way this works is that the programmable router receives a packet, which is for traceroute, it's a UDP packet. It determines that it needs to modify this packet somehow, and before it modifies it, it stores the original values of the source and destination of this packet in an additional header. It sends this packet to the router where it will expire. The router sends back this packet, sends back the notification that the packet has expired. This notification contains the original packet, including the custom header that we added. Now the device can read this header again, restore the original values, remove the header, and send the packet back to the sender. So by this, we avoid keeping any dynamic state in the programmable devices, which would be a problem because of the very limited memory that is typically available there. Now, in the last part of my talk, I want to give you some brief insights in the evaluation that we did. We did a number of experiments to measure the accuracy and utility that we observe with different amounts of obfuscation, how our obfuscation algorithm performs, how it affects timing of packets, how it works if only a few small number of devices in the network are programmable, and these security simulations that I mentioned earlier. And we did these measurements with three different topologies of different sizes. But unfortunately, I don't have time to go into the details of all of them here. Instead, I will focus on the experiment where we analyzed the accuracy and utility for the medium-sized topology. And this experiment we did depending on the flow density reduction, which is kind of a measure of how much we obfuscated the topology. So a flow density reduction of zero would mean we didn't need to apply any obfuscation at all. While if we have, for example, in the physical topology, 100 flows on each link, and in the virtual topology, we want only 20% of flows of on each link, we would have a flow density reduction from 100 to 20, so of 80%. And we did these simulations with two approaches. First, with our net height system, and also as a baseline, we included the results of a naive random algorithm that would just add random links to obfuscate the topology such that the flow density is low enough. And we see that even for high amounts of obfuscation, so for example, for this 80% of flow density reduction, we still get high values for accuracy and utility, for accuracy here in this plot, and for the utility here in this plot. And furthermore, we see that at this point where we obfuscate, or where we reduce the flow density by 80%, we don't need to modify 82% of the path at all. So this means for 82% of the path in the network, we don't apply any obfuscation at all. The debugging possibilities are unmodified there. So this already brings me to the end of the talk. I hope I could show you how NetHide takes the physical network topology, creates a virtual topology that is similar but does not show vulnerabilities against link flooding attacks, then how it deploys this virtual topology in the network using programmable network devices, and in the last part, I hope I could show you some insights in the evaluation that we did. I'm happy to answer questions now, and I will also be at the poster session in the afternoon if you maybe want to have longer discussions. Thank you.
Thanks for the talk. So this requires the routers on the path to run P4 or to allow programmability. How many of the routers on the internet actually allow that?
It requires at least one router on the path for this path that we need to obfuscate to run P4. But we are not really looking at the internet. Like, the focus here is more on a single operator network topology. So on the internet topology, you wouldn't probably you don't have the P4 routers, and for sure you don't have the possibility to program them.
Thanks.
Thank you for the talk. It was really great. I think I missed it. Could you explain how you do the optimization problem and how you know inversion hardness? I didn't quite catch that. It was a little fast for me.
Yes, so for the optimization problem, we do this sampling. So we take all, we have all the nodes. We don't modify the nodes, the routers. And then we assume we could have a complete graph. So we have all possible links in this topology. We sample forwarding behaviors towards each node. So this is like forwarding behavior. This means that paths from each other node towards this node. We sample a certain number of them, like maybe 1,000 of them for each node. And then we pick the combination of the best of these n times 1,000 forwarding behaviors that gives us the maximum accuracy and utility.
Hey, so is the topology fixed or you timely randomize it? So if it is fixed, is that possible for attackers to just randomly send some packet and watch the delay and try to guess the topology?
Can you say the first part of your question again?
I mean, is the topology fixed or you timely randomize the topology, say days or months?
The topology is fixed, yes.
Yeah, if it's fixed, is it possible for attackers to, say, randomly send some packet from some bot and see, watch the delay and try to guess the real topology, and then they randomize it?
The delays, we don't randomize the delays. We keep the delay.
So attackers can watch the delay and see, try to guess what could be the topology and try to de-randomize it. Is that possible? How hard it is?
Yeah, this... Yes, so timing attacks, it can be an issue if you have certain links with a very different timing from others. But like if you have an intercontinental link and very short links, then you might be able to distinguish between them by looking at the timing. But in general, when you do this trace route or these probing tool techniques, the vast amount of the timing that you observe is by the destination router to generate the ICMP, this reply to the packet. So this is the control plane. And the variance that you get in the timing, it comes from the router and not from the propagation delay in the topology.
Okay.
And what we also have is that the difference in path length, it was not here in the presentation, but the path that we present and the real path are of very similar length. So in maybe one or two hops difference, and then it makes it very hard to distinguish based on the timing.
Okay, thank you.
So let's thank the speaker again.